Accession number 20457, rail 21.
Brigadier Randall, rail 21. Did you have long-term warning that you were going to be shifted to Singapore from Hong Kong?
Well, yeah, we were told we were going to British Somaliland. Or the battalion had been actually out in the east since 1927. So this was nearly a quarter of a century later. And they were just getting to get back to the sort of peacetime roulement of units. And so the battalion was due to go home. And I think the plan one time, we were going to go and do a short term in Somaliland, for some reason I don't understand, and then go home to England. That was changed and we were sent down to Selarang Barracks in Singapore for sort of internal security duties on the island. There were two battalions, the Seaforth and us.
Were you en route to Somaliland then, and were you diverted?
No, we were told that. Then that was cancelled.
Oh, I see. Right.
Yeah, they were cancelled. I don't know why. I mean, the British Army had all these imperial commitments all round the world, with the diminishing resources at the time.
Nothing new then.
Nothing new, no. Exactly. Anyway, down we went to Singapore, which most of us viewed as a sort of a downward step. I mean, Hong Kong was fun, whereas Singapore somehow. Anyway, down we went to Singapore.
So you're saying that Singapore was not fun?
It seemed to be not such an exciting, interesting place as to me, anyway. We were in very much more comfortable barracks, but of course the climate was different. I joined in Hong Kong in the cold weather, of course, which was super. I mean, I hadn't been through a Hong Kong hot weather, I might have had a different view. Well, to go down to Singapore right on the equator, even though we were in very comfortable barracks, it seemed a little bit to an anticlimax. Anyway, there we were a sort of internal security battalion, not doing very much. Again, training hours were very limited. We were doing lots of individual training, a lot of range work. My wife wasn't allowed to join me. And by that time, I'd done 7 years regimental service. So a combination of those two, I applied to go to the staff, and so I was posted as a G3 trainee in GHQ Foros. And once, unfortunately for me, after this was all confirmed and my wife was coming out, then the emergency started in Malaya. Had I not gone off, I don't think I could have gone off because people would have said, oh, well, John Randall's windy. And I couldn't very well have gone off. But I'd actually been posted just about to take it off. My wife had arrived. They let it be.
Was there a serious internal security threat in Singapore itself when you got there?
Well, again, it wasn't a serious one, but at that time, I think there was always the potential threat of trouble between the Malays and the Chinese, I think.
Were there any disorders at the time you were there?
No. I don't recall any, no. We did have a sort of internal security scheme. I think we had to go out and man sort of VIP, VPs, vulnerable points. I think it's like little power stations, and there was a sort of plan, but I mean, but we never rehearsed it. We never did it really very much.
I was going to ask if you did any training for internal security.
No, we weren't, no.
No riot drills or anything like that?
Nothing like that, no. I mean, there didn't seem to be. I don't recall any sort of serious attention being given to anti-British riots or anything at that time. So we were just, sort of, again, sort of settling down to the life of a sort of garrison battalion with no specific sort of operation in view, but just to be around in case we might be needed for business. Anyway.
Did the emergency affect you then when it
I just joined this job and my wife had arrived. I was in the training department, which was quite busy because they realised quite early on that they were going to need to probably have reinforcement troops sent out, and there was a need to have some sort of jungle doctrine adapted to the particular circumstances of the communist gangs, and to have places where NCOs and officers could go through jungle warfare courses. And so quite early on, our branch did set up this jungle warfare training centre. I was only involved, I mean, as a third grade officer, I've only very much on the fringe of that, but that was very sensible, actually. I mean, I think they got it right there. In fact, the chap who was appointed to do it was a chap called Walter Walker, who then became a big shot in the Borneo operations 20 years later. And
was he the head of the training department?
No, he wasn't the star. Well, I remember looking around for someone who had got the experience to become the commandant of this jungle warfare training centre. And this chap, Walter Walker, who I think was just giving up command of a Gurkha battalion. But he set it up. And I was involved in the sort of lower things about getting the equipment stuff and getting the training areas and that sort of thing involved for this jungle warfare training centre, which is just across the... It was in Johor Bahru. It wasn't on the island at all.
What sort of equipment did they need to create this training facility?
Well, I think we had to sort of try. I seem to remember the main problem was sort of stuff for jungle target lanes, that sort of thing, and booby trap equipment and that sort of thing. There was quite an emphasis, quite rightly, on snap shooting ranges and that sort of thing. That, I think, it was the main sort of thing, and signal equipment, of course.
How many of you were there in that staff, the training staff?
There was a full colonel and one lieutenant colonel and about four majors and about four or five captains.
That's quite a large staff.
Yeah, it was a pretty big place, GHQ Far Off, enormous really. Mm. But I was studying for the staff, I was also studying for the staff college.
Was it mainly paperwork, administrative paperwork, that you were having to do in this?
Yeah, I didn't get up very much, I'm afraid, no. It was a pretty, looking back, it was a valuable experience of third grade staff work, but it was pretty boring, really. And one lived in a jolly hot old office with a sort of wood knot with an attap roof, and it was, the afternoons, it was pretty difficult to do much work. There was no central heating. I mean, no air conditioning, and therefore, you either had, if you had the fan on in the winter, I think all your paper blew around. I didn't have any earth-shaking responsibilities, but at least I learned to. I learned how big headquarters worked, and of course I could have my wife with me, and I didn't have to work at weekends, and I. very seldom, if ever, had to work after 5 o'clock.
So I was going to ask if you had a standard routine working day.
Well, that's right, yes. So, I mean, and one had quite a pleasant sort of life. So, though I was pretty broke because we couldn't have a quarter, so we had to go live in a sort of shack place. I was literally right by the sea out at Changi Jail, but I was so broke we hadn't got a car. The army lent me a motorcycle to drive to and fro about 15 miles to work. And quite illegally, I used to take my wife off to the pictures of the pillion. And then she got a job, because I hadn't got any kids then. And so financially, I wasn't living the style of a... no going off to the Tanglin Club. Do you know the Far East? No. Well, I wasn't living... but we had fun. We had our own place right down by the sea. You could bathe and that sort of thing, and some friends. Anyway, but I was able to study for the staff college, which was the main thing.
How would you normally spend a day when you were the G3 training then? What time would you arrive?
Well, you arrived about 9.
Yeah, and then
and just deal with the sort of incoming... I was also responsible for all the course vacancies.
Yes.
So I was just routine stuff. I mean, you asked... we had 3 subordinate commands. We had Hong Kong 4. We had Singapore District, Malaya District, Hong Kong, and British Troops Ceylon. And we call for bids for all sorts of courses, and then I'd consolidate them, and that sort of business. And then I was responsible for all the films, training films, and not entertainment, all training films, and that sort of thing. I mean, it was just very, very low-grade staff work, really. I mean, it can be done by an intelligent corporal, actually, in my view.
Did you have a good staff of clerks to support you?
We had Chinese clerks, yeah, they were all right, yes.
Was most of your work done by correspondence?
By signal.
By signal?
Yeah, well, I mean, yes, largely by signal, because correspondence to places like Hong Kong, or even up to Malaya, took time, really. Mm. So one tended to use signals a lot.
What about telephone?
Yeah, you could, but... you could obviously phone Singapore District, and you've discouraged to use too much phone up to... Once the emergency got going, they like to keep the lines fairly clear, so... But yeah, I could talk to my sort of oppo up in Kuala Lumpur.
What about things like conferences and meetings? Did you have a lot of those to attend?
Well, not really, no. That was really done by my bosses. I mean, they were the sort of conference chaps. I was the chap who had to... to the outcome. What I mean, in those days, a G3 work was really very low, very sort of low grade, actually. When I was in the position to employ G3s later on, I tried to give them a good deal more challenging work to do than I was given.
What were you studying then? What did you have to study in order to...
Staff College?
To go to the Staff College, yes.
Well, there were 3 tactics papers. Military history. Military law. And then I think a paper called Adam and Morale. I think that was about it.
And what method of study did you use? Did you attend?
I did correspondence course from England. It took a long time to get to and fro. Mm.
Do you know who was running that correspondence course?
I can't remember now. I think it was a chap I dealt with, was a sort of retired Major General who was employed by them. My branch of GHQ actually were responsible for running a pre-staff college course, which I attended. At the end of which they tell me I hadn't got a hope in hell of passing. I think one of the reasons why I passed was because I was so bloody annoyed with their thing that I said, I'll prove you wrong. Current affairs, of course. So one was encouraged to read intelligent newspapers and read the sort of things that ABCA and those sort of things that used to come out, actually. Of course, some of the things you could play off the cuff because of, I mean, military history. I knew there were going to be at least two or three questions on Burma, so you could play that off the cuff. And tactics. I had to concentrate on the sort of military law and that sort of thing. It wasn't very easy studying in it because it was jolly hot there, but I persevered at it, and I think out of it, it was 30 or 28 of it took it from the four. Only five of us managed to get through, and I was one of the five, which surprised everybody in my branch. And it surprised me too, actually, to be honest. I was at sea in a cruiser. My boss went and dinner with a captain of a HMS London. Had just come down the Yangtze after the Amethyst business, and he said, "Would you like to send some officers?" So I had a word with my wife. She said, "Do you mind?" She said, "No, we'll get a chance." So I went for a cruise around Borneo in this cruiser, and while I was at somewhere off Borneo, a signal came through saying I'd pass it. So the Navy, not really understanding very much about it, but any excuse to have a party. So we had one hell of a party. But I got to tell you what, I was a duty officer in GHQ when the Amethyst made its break down the Yangtze.
How often?
And these signals came flooding in, and I thought, what the hell? You know, this is. What do I do? I mean, I'm only a captain. Do I wake up the Major General Chief of Staff? Or not, and it's not an easy decision ever to make, actually. So I thought I would be, if doubt, do the positive thing. So I thought, well, I'd better ring him up and tell him. And if I get my balls chewed off, well, okay. But I'd rather get it chewed off having done something than done nothing. So I rang him up, and he was a chap called General Kirkman. And I said, I think you ought to know this is happening. And he said, you've done quite the right thing, boy. Unless you think there's anything that's going to involve the army, give me a ring at 6 o'clock. Went back to sleep, so that was fine at 6 o'clock. But it was quite interesting sitting there, because throughout the night, you know, the signals were coming through. They were coming from naval headquarters in Hong Kong to naval headquarters in Singapore, but they were copied to the army. So one was, in a strange sort of way, only via signals, but one was an observer of one of the great post-war military dramas, actually. It was quite an interesting thing. I can't remember now, but Amethyst is on its way, and then the reports of gunfire, and then other ships were going up to rescue it, and it was all really quite a dramatic night. However, all was well.
She got away with it.
Anyway, he was very decent. He said, you've done the right thing. And of course, I signed off at 8 o'clock in the morning, but it was just an interesting experience to be, albeit a very flank sort of observer of that sort of incident.
What sort of staff would be on duty at night?
I think it was just me, the captain or major, and I think you had a duty clerk. And of course, the signals office was the main GHQ fire signal. That of course was open 24 hours of the day,
How often did?
And then signals were. I think only. I mean, didn't see every signal was coming in. I mean, only signals of any priority.
Mm. How often would this duty come round?
Came round about once. About once every 2 months, I think, something like that. It was quite a chore. You would have to sleep in a bloody, awful, uncomfortable office. And you were, actually, there was always signals coming. You didn't get much sleep. But, of course, you came off duty. I mean, you came off from your normal job, did this job, went back onto it. Mm. You did have a break to go and have some lunch, some dinner, I think, but it wasn't a very welcome duty.
How was the headquarters laid out? Was there an ops room?
Oh, yes. It was basically a tangling on all of these hastily constructed atap, you know, which is sort of just wooden huts with coconut palm leaf on top. But there was an ops headquarters in a permanent building. And of course it was quite busy because there was the British were heavily involved in operations supporting the French in Indochina. Well, not supporting them, but keeping it. And the Dutch in the Netherlands East Indies.
Well, there were a lot of military operations going on all the way around, weren't there? You've got the Civil War in China coming towards its climax.
Yes.
There was trouble in the Philippines, I think, at that
yes,
time.
Yes, there was,
yes. The Willahat movement.
Yes.
The Dutch police actions in Indonesia.
Yes.
And then the French getting
and the French getting to
Indochina.
Indochina. So it was quite a sort of a... Far East was sort of bubbling over, really.
A very active theatre at that
time. Oh, it was. Oh, yes. Yes. It was quite a busy sort of time, really.
You were saying that you were involved in setting up a training centre for jungle warfare. Was there not already some sort of jungle warfare training facility because of the lessons of Burma?
No, I think they had one in Burma, but then Burma packed up in, I think, January, February 48.
Yes.
And I didn't join the staff there till 6 months later. Mm. So, but no, there wasn't. It was obvious gap, but because Burma had been the sort of as the sort of jungle warfare theatre, and when that packed up, they hadn't got round to thinking about maintaining the doctrine of jungle warfare. And I don't think they would have done it had not been for this emergency.
But this is a different kind of jungle warfare, isn't it? Because in Burma, and during fighting against the Japanese, you were fighting against a regular army, whereas in Malaya, it's a question of counterinsurgency jungle.
Entirely, yes. So, but there were certain, yes, it's quite true. But I think a lot of the emphasis on training at the jungle was just personal survival in the jungle. That sort of business, just the sort of basic individual stuff, really. Getting the doctrine right for how to build sort of waterproof shelters and purifying water and fruits and things from the jungle you could eat and
this sounds more like survival training than
there's quite a lot of that would form part of the syllabus, which of course hadn't really been a feature of fighting in Burma because you didn't have to do this sort of long patrols deep into the jungle. But it wasn't that sort of war. So you're quite right. I mean, it was a different sort of war.
Well, you mentioned Walter Walker. Was he the man who actually wrote the doctrine for this new training centre?
Well, he was certainly an inspirational figure. I mean, I don't really know. He got together teams of instructors, mostly from Gurkha regiments, who'd been in Burma, and I think he had he was the commandant. I think he did have he obviously had a sort of chief instructor, but they hammered out a sort of doctrine.
Did you get involved in doing that in any way?
No, not in that. But then, of course, it had. They had to constantly modify it because. As the pattern of warfare developed in Malaya. I mean, it started off, as you know, basically with all of a sudden these sort of attacks on rubber estates. And it wasn't really until Briggs came out, later of the Baluch regiment, I would add, and produced the Briggs Plan, which was then implemented to largely by Templer. But it wasn't until the Hearts and Minds and the sort of the bringing all the villagers in, and that, so that as the sort of civil approach to the problem, the strategy or the concept, the military obviously had to adapt their tactics and operations to dovetail in with this. It was constantly changing, I think. It wasn't a question of laying down a doctrine and leaving it like that. It was a question of adapting it as the situation arose.
To me it seems rather strange they hadn't brought you in on that process, because you'd fought in jungle and you'd also been involved in the anti-Dacoit operations, which might have had some similarity to dealing with the terrorist
gangs.
Yeah,
but there were a lot of other chaps around who'd done a lot of fighting. And it didn't seem to me to be, as a sort of, be a captain, start putting my hand up. Didn't seem, I had to be a bit careful, really. I might think, well, who the bloody hell do you think you are?
But it's often said that counterinsurgency is really a war fought by corporals and,
yes,
and junior officers, yes, rather than by senior officers.
I think I could have contributed something, but it wasn't my job to be involved in that. And nobody... You see, the 17th Division went to, which had been largely Gurkha battalions, and there was in the Far East at that time a sort of bunch of ex or serving Gurkha officers who, and I've got the highest admiration for Gurkhas and for Gurkha officers, but the fact is that they were a little bit arrogant. They felt that they really didn't. Nobody else knew anything about fighting the jungle except Gurkhas, and everybody else was a load of rubbish. Certainly the Devons, when they went up there under a Gurkha brigadier, found him, I mean, he was rabidly anti-British. He had no time for British soldiers at all. And therefore, I don't want to overstress this, but it was very much, the Gurkhas felt it, jungle warfare was their pigeon, their little, and that everybody else was slightly hanging on their coattail.
Apart from this requirement for and jungle warfare training to deal with the emergency, were there any other developments in training at Far East Land Forces when you were there?
No, this really sort of absorbed everybody's interest, really. And there was no strategic or tactical. There was nothing else in the immediate horizon which led us to believe that we would be involved in any other sort of operations, because I mean it wasn't till after I'd left about 1950 when the Korea War started, and the communists got really militant with the threat to Hong Kong. Well, we did actually, when I was there, they did reinforce Hong Kong. They did indeed, when I was there. That was building up just about the time I left at the end of 49. But it wasn't. But again, that was to Hong Kong.
Not to your area.
But it wasn't really until the Korean War that I think people really... Then I think things did change, but I don't know, I wasn't there.
Did the emergency require you to take any particular precautions or measures for your own safety?
None at all in Singapore. Every now and again one had to go up on the night train. I can't remember why now. I think one was a courier or something, because the telephone lines were very insecure. And signals also, I suppose, were. So I think every night somebody went up with a sort of, as a courier, and you went up on the, and you were also made OC the train. A train used to go up from Singapore. So I went up once or twice on there.
To Kuala Lumpur.
Mm. And then you spent the day there, and then you came back the next night. And on the train, you had to sort of keep awake and you had guards and that sort of thing, in case the train was ambushed. I don't think it ever was, but I think it was shot up once or twice.
But Singapore wasn't troubled at all by the emergency?
None at all. I mean, I think it's quite disgraceful that we were all given the General Service Medal malaise. I mean, I think it was quite bogus. It's not something, that particular bar, nothing I feel I really heard. I think it was just...